Hello and welcome to a very special episode of On the Edge with Andrew Gold. I got to meet in real life and hang out with the one and only Richard Dawkins. Many of you will know who he is, some might not. He is a prominent, perhaps the world's most prominent evolutionary biologist, and he became very well known, I think, was it the 80s? That's the kind of thing that the podcast is supposed to know. Let me look that up. God Delusion. I'm keeping you all in the know. So the God Delusion was 2006. And then there was the Selfish Gene, which was 1976. Popular science and all those kinds of things helping us to understand how we became who we are today, but also popularizing, speaking openly about atheism. And part of that over the years has included warning against all kinds of magical thinking. And like many, I suppose, scientists who don't suffer fools gladly, he's also talked negatively about some of the postmodern ideas going around universities and academia today. I'm talking about the sort of woke culture. I know no one, everyone's going, oh, don't say the word woke because you're not supposed to say it anymore. But I think it's actually a good word. Everybody hates that word. I think it's a really good word because it so perfectly encapsulates, it sums up exactly what most people think it is. Whether that's a positive or negative thing depends on who you are and what your opinions are. But he became a little bit outspoken recently, saying, look, there are two sexes, stop talking about it as if there aren't, you know, and whether there's this thing called gender, some sort of social construct, as an irrelevant argument as to the policies and things that people put into place around, kind of trans person being the same changing room, a trans woman with in women's changing rooms and sports and things like that. So he's spoken out a bit about that kind of thing. He was recently on Piers Morgan's show where he spoke about that and refused to answer certain questions about Islam, which a lot of people found very sad because this very heroic, outspoken person had been subdued to an extent and scared, like many of us are, to speak out against something that might get them killed. Anyway, we talk about all of those things and more. We go into atheism, what it's like when we die, our ways we can stop thinking about that, different kinds of aliens and what they might look like. We talk about Piers Morgan and have a bit of a gossip about him, which was a lot of fun. And I, throughout, felt very scared and nervous because Richard sometimes just, he's got this way of answering very precisely, and which is great in many respects, but also means you have to have a lot of questions ready to fill the hour. But really it was fantastic getting to meet a hero of mine. So Richard Dawkins, he has a Substack called The Poetry of Reality, where he asks that you discuss several very, very interesting concepts. And that is going to be turned into a podcast very soon. So do check out The Poetry of Reality on, type that in on Richard Dawkins' Substack. You can sign up and get his newsletter. And that will keep you up to date with when the podcast will be coming out. Other big episodes coming up. It's David Baddiel next. Also talking about belief and atheism and why he loves God despite being an atheist. So that was really interesting, getting to talk to another hero of mine, and some other really big episodes coming up. But now you're on the edge of, the God Delusion and the Selfish Gene with Richard Dawkins. Richard, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Good, good. I spoke to David Baddiel yesterday. He's got a new book out called, and I was interviewing him, and I accidentally started the podcast by saying, David Baddiel, who wrote the God Delusion. And he went, no, stop, I'll stop you there. It's the God Desire. Have you come across it?
I've come across him, I think, but anyway, carry on.
He's the comedian who wrote, he wrote Football's Coming Home.
Yes.
And several other things.
Yes.
He's a, you know, stand-up comedian. And I think he said, somebody asked for him to sign his book, and it was your nephew, or they said they were your nephew. Is that possible?
Possible.
I don't know. Yeah,
I haven't heard about it, but maybe.
That is possible. I think you and him are both phenomenal thinkers. One of the things I discussed with David is he was talking about where he differs from you, because you're both atheists and he writes about atheism. And he said that he believes sometimes there's sort of a macho thing going on in atheism where we say we're not scared of certain things. Ricky Gervais, for example, and I've heard you say about the afterlife, you know, I was not alive for a very long time before. I'm not going to be alive, so it doesn't bother me. Is that how you really feel, or is it something you have to say to yourself for comfort?
It's something I feel. I don't think of it as macho. I mean, it's just rational, actually. I mean, I think I probably quoted Mark Twain saying, "I was dead for billions of years before I was born and never suffered the smallest inconvenience."
Yeah, David, I think he quoted Bertrand Russell, who said a similar thing along the line, which is what he was saying was macho, I think, about the scorn for people who fear death.
Yeah, Bertrand Russell said, "When I die, I shall rot, and nothing of my ego shall survive. I'm not a young man, and I love life, but I would scorn to shiver with terror at the thought of annihilation." That's an exact quote from Bertrand Russell.
How do you have these?
I don't have many. I don't know.
I even looked at it just before, and I already forgot half the words. So it's just the way different minds work, I suppose. Mine doesn't work quite so well. But David was saying, you know, he does fear the death, the afterlife, and or no afterlife, I should say, and the fact that, I guess his point was, right now I am alive and I do feel things. So right now I do fear that there'll be nothing afterwards.
Yes, it's very understandable. We have to live in the moment, because when we're dead, we don't exist at all, and so there's nothing to fear there. There's a lot to miss, because you, if you love life, as Bertrand Russell said he did, and I do, then it's very sad to miss life. It's very sad to miss out, if you're a scientist, on all the things that are going to happen. I mean, things are developing all the time, and it would be wonderful to know what people will know in 500 years' time. That would be a supremely interesting thing. And so it is sad to miss that.
Yeah. It actually keeps me up at night. So I had this whole existential crisis talking to David Baddiel yesterday, just thinking, what can I think of that will comfort me in this? And I guess that's what I mean when I say, so Ricky Gervais also said that, you know, I was dead for millions of years before, I'd be dead for eternity
yes.
after. It doesn't work for me to comfort me. Have you
yes,
got anything?
Yes, I'm not really, no. I just don't think there's any point in being comforted by a lie.
No.
So better face up to the truth, really.
If you could inject a serum into your mind or something that would make you believe the lie, just for comfort's sake, would you do that?
No, I don't think so. It's an interesting question. And make me believe a lie, no. Make me not worry about a truth that worries me about it. But I worry about it present, yes, I think. I can't think of an example, but I could imagine being frightened of something or being upset about something, and a drug that you inject that makes you no longer upset. But I don't think I'd want a drug that made me believe a falsehood.
I suppose that's a bit Brave New World with the soma that they put into
it. It's a very good parallel, yes. And the savage in Brave New World actually had this argument with the world controller, Mustafa Mond, where the savage was saying, "Shakespeare's good," and Mustafa Mond was saying, "Yes, but the downside of that is you have all the terrible emotions and sadness and things that you get in Hamlet and Othello and Romeo and Juliet." And the savage was saying, "That's what I want." And Mustafa Mond said, "You're welcome."
When I read that as a teenager, I was on the side of the savage going, "Yeah, Shakespeare's great," and all this
yes.
stuff. And I reread it recently and I found myself a little less clear on where
yes.
I stand. Because
yes.
I thought, gosh, I do worry a lot, and it would be nice to just take a drug
yes,
and be fine.
Yes, 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 I can see that.
But you wouldn't take that one that makes you believe there's an afterlife.
I wouldn't want one that makes me believe in a falsehood. I might take one that makes me not worry about something I do worry about.
A lot of my viewers and subscribers do believe in an afterlife. They believe in religions and things, because this channel, primarily at the moment, we focus on cults and things like Scientology. Often they'll say, I can't believe people believe in Lord Xenu from Scientology, but the real God is our Lord and Jesus and things like that. I don't want to alienate those people, of course, who are watching and might be interested. But one thing I was wondering, and I think you actually, there was a recent interview you did with Piers Morgan and you sort of touched on it. I think it felt like you didn't really believe that he believed that there's this afterlife and God and things like that. And
I said that, yes.
Yeah. How do you think they don't deep down believe it?
I can't speak for them in the abstract. Something made me think Piers Morgan didn't believe. I think Piers Morgan's a fool. I'm not really much interested in what he believes, actually.
Oh, you said something similar off air, and I didn't think you would repeat
well,
it. Well, he definitely interrupts a lot, doesn't he?
Sure, you can say that again.
So you think he doesn't? Oh, I don't know. So maybe he's playing to his, or some people might play to their spectators.
There's maybe plenty of people who play to their audience, yes.
And suggest they have a belief in spirituality,
yeah,
God,
yes,
and things like
yes.
that. Man, I always wondered that. I suppose there's so many examples of people who are religious, but when they're about to die, again, I remember now Piers Morgan was saying, doesn't it give you comfort thinking that they're going to the afterlife, of friends of yours and things? But people don't. People are terribly depressed when their friends die.
If they really did believe it, then they'd be saying things like, oh, you're going to die. Good for you.
Yeah.
Give my love to Uncle Charles when you see him.
Yeah. I'll come with.
Yes. Yeah.
How fantastic. I wonder if belief is sometimes, you've seen my exorcism film, and
yes.
I do work on cults and things like that. Do you think belief might be... of course, it's a coping mechanism for the afterlife and not knowing what's happening when we die. But is it also, for some people, an excuse to do terrible things?
In what way?
If I believe that there's a God and I'm working for him, I can...
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, if you really, really believe that your God wants you to kill infidels, and some do, and they really, really believe it, that is... very dangerous, of course.
Yeah. Do you think there's something about the human need to believe in these things? Like, what is it about us that makes us believe?
I don't understand why something that you can call a need to believe, or getting comfort from belief, actually makes you believe. You can't will yourself to believe something. Either you believe it or you don't. You can't say, I want to believe so-and-so, therefore I do. If the evidence doesn't support it, how can you believe it?
Well, people often bring up Pascal's wager, don't they? And they say...
Well, ridiculous, yes.
I get told it all the time, like, you might as well believe, because then you can go... And it's like, do your beliefs work that way, that you can just make yourself believe a thing?
Well, that's, of course, one point. You can't make yourself believe something. And the other thing about... Plenty of things about Pascal's wager. Another thing is, maybe it's the wrong God. I mean, you get up there and discover he's Baal or Mithras.
Or Piers Morgan.
So no, I mean, even if the God you think you're sucking up to, what kind of a good God would reward you for sucking up in that way rather than actually being rational?
I often think that as well. If there's a God, he doesn't want me to be on my knees doing all this pious, boring stuff.
No.
I don't know. At what point in your life did you realize you were an atheist?
About 15.
Do you remember what made that happen?
Well, understanding Darwinism.
Well, I think that's fair enough. At some stage in your past, every animal who ever lived belonged to the same species as its parent, yet you are descended from a fish.
Yes.
Can you explain?
Well, that's absolutely true. You are descended from a fish. So if you go back and back and back and back and back far enough, you'll come to a fish. And yet, every single generation is the same species as the previous generation. The change is so gradual. So it's like when you change from a child to a teenager to an adult to a middle age to an old. There's no one day when you say, I've stopped being middle aged now, and my birthday's come and I'm now old, or I've stopped being a teenager. Actually, well, that's the one case where legally you can say that I'm now reached voting age, which is a fiction, of course. But actually, it's a gradual change all the way through. Embryo to baby to infant to toddler to etc. And so there's no one moment when you change from one of these states to another. And exactly the same in our ancestry. There's no one moment when any species changes into another species. It happens all gradually. But if you take that gradual process back and back and back far enough, you'll come to a fish.
That's amazing. Was there then,
And I'm being slightly facetious when I ask, because I don't know enough about it. But was there then one fish, and then the fish's son had like half a leg, and then like a tiny bit of a leg, and so on?
Well, kind of, yes. Okay, I wouldn't put it like that, but yeah. Sort of, yes.
Sort of, how is it? How would you put it? How did it happen?
Well, there was a group of fish which did have fins, which were kind of like legs, and which were evolved into legs. And the modern relations of those fish are lungfish and coelacanths. And they were a group of fish on their own. They were once rather widespread, and now they're rather rare, except that we are descended from them. And they were fish whose fins became leg-like, and they emerged onto the land, and their fins turned into legs. And you can trace the actual bones which became the humerus and the radius and the ulna and the femur and the tibia and the fibula. So that's pretty much what happened. But it happened so gradually, you would never have had there would never have been a moment when you said, oh, it's no longer a fish.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I find that's fascinating, and
it's logically necessary. I'm not revealing to you any facts. It's just once you accept it, well, that of course is a fact. But once you've accepted that, then what I've just said has to follow.
And then religion, as we know it, and those kinds of beliefs can't then follow.
Well, that's a separate issue.
Yeah. Well, going back to that, then, are there other kinds of magical thinking? I'm thinking particularly of what's happened recently with sort of Maori New Zealand language. Is that another kind of sort of the so-called postmodernism? Is that
well, I think you're alluding to a controversy which has arisen in New Zealand recently, which I got involved in because I was in New Zealand, where the New Zealand government is trying to push the idea that Maori, quote, ways of knowing should be taught in science classes. And it's this sort of bending over backwards to be nice to an indigenous minority. Of course, my view is, of course, you need to teach the mythology of the country in which you live. And that's important as mythology, but not as science. And it's simply confusing and muddling to New Zealand children to teach them, on the one hand, to teach them what we know about the origin of the universe and the origin of the world, and we know quite a lot, not everything, and at the same time to say that it's because of the sky father and the earth mother and stuff like that, which is pure mythology.
Yeah, I think you were saying that you wrote that there are some bits that some good bits we can take from Maori.
Well, of course you can. I mean, you can take some bits from it, from any cultures, folk beliefs, but there's no particular reason why you should take the folk mythology of one people any more than any other. I mean, scientific knowledge is unique and it's worldwide. They wrongly categorize it as Western. It's not Western at all. It belongs to all of humanity. Science is the way we know about the truth. Science is has equipped itself with mechanisms for avoiding self-deception, subjective judgment. So the only approach to the truth is the scientific way, and that belongs to all humanity and is not to be regarded as, you just mentioned postmodernism just now, not to be regarded as the property of one particular cultural group.
It reminds me of, I had a Professor John McWhorter, he came on to the linguist, to talk about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, the idea that language can shape feelings and, and almost give you superpowers to an extent. You know, there's a tribe in Australia that apparently can use like a GPS in their head, a satellite navigation, because they use west and north and east instead of left and right. It's all a bit wishy-washy. And a lot of people in linguistics are trying to say that, look at all these other languages that bestow us with superpowers and they're better languages. And John McWhorter said, the problem with that kind of talk is we have to then say that there are also things in our language that are better, clearly, than in other languages, and nobody wants to do that in academia. Is that a problem you find in academia in general?
Yes, I wasn't aware of that particular... I read some of John McWhorter, but I wasn't aware of that. It sounds very interesting.
He's great, So do you come up against... I mean, do you have colleagues and professors who you think, gosh, why are you towing to this kind of... I suppose it's woke is a word that no one likes to use these days, but that kind of thing.
I don't have many colleagues who do, but I read about them.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. Is that something that should be put in the sort of beliefs box alongside belief in a deity?
Well, you'd have to specify what you mean, but I'm inclined to think yes. I don't mean it is a religion in all respects, but there are similarities. It's not supernatural, but things like the collective guilt which white people are encouraged to feel about the dark past of slavery and things has a very strong resonance with original sin, the Christian doctrine that we're all born in sin, the sin of Adam. We inherit the sin of Adam. Adam never existed, and they know that, but nevertheless still talk about it as original sin. So that there is that. I think John McWhorter has actually made that analogy. I believe he has. If he hasn't, I have anyway. So that's a powerful analogy to religion. The belief that you can become a woman by saying you're a woman. And so even if you have the anatomy of a man, even if you have a penis and a scrotum and things, you, by simply standing up and saying, I am a woman, you become a woman. That's very like the Catholic doctrine that by a priest blessing bread and wine, it becomes the body and blood of Christ. And the Catholic theological justification for that is the Aristotelian distinction between the essence of something, the true substance, and the accidentals. The fact that wine remains an alcoholic liquid is just its accidentals, and the true substance becomes the blood of Christ. And that's very like saying the accidentals of my body is male, but the true substance is I'm a female because I declare myself to be female. So that's another analogy with, in this case, Christianity.
Would that suggest that Christianity, there's something about Christianity that is innate to our evolutionary psychology, that original sin, for example?
I don't know about that. You're probably thinking of some sort of Jungian archetype there. I suppose it's just possible. I wouldn't want to pursue that too far, I don't think.
I quite like the concept of the status game by Will Storr, this writer who I admire very much, who I think he just sort of popularized this idea that there are three main kinds of status, and we all seek it in tribes. It's evolutionary psychology, and you might tell me this is nonsense. I don't know, because I don't know much about this stuff. But one would be dominance. You seek dominance because if you're the most dominant in the tribe, you'll get food and shelter.
I think that sort of thing is plausible, I think that that's the kind of good thing that we can get out of evolutionary psychology, yes.
I find that fascinating. Yes. And success is another one. If you invented the wheel, they're going to give you some food and shelter.
Yes.
And then if you're not successful or dominant, you resort to the third one, which is virtue. And you don't have to be a virtuous person. You just have to show the rest of the tribe that you are virtuous.
Yes.
Does that ring true to you?
Yes, it does, yeah.
I wonder if that's just going on. But I guess when it's so obvious, it doesn't work. So if somebody's trying to be, if someone's too obvious about trying to be virtuous in that tribe, you would all just go, get out of here.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So I don't know. So I wonder if virtue signaling is part of our evolutionary psychology and maybe magical thinking as well to an extent. Did that help us survive?
I think virtue signaling could be magical thinking. I suppose it could, you could get status by getting a reputation as a magician who's able to commune with spirits or something.
That's true.
A witch doctor or... Yeah.
How do you get status then? Because we all have, if we all seek it, and I don't think you do by virtue, would it be success? What is it? What does that, did that drive you over the years? I've heard you mention physics envy. I know you're not a physicist.
Well, I've never said that I suffer from physics envy myself, I don't think, but it's a witticism which I attribute to Peter Medawar. I'm not sure if that's right.
Biology envy, is there such a thing?
I don't know. I mean, academics generally, I think, seek status just like anybody else does, but I don't want to go into that too much.
The reason I thought of it is because, you know, you had this interview last year, I think, with Jordan Peterson, and I noticed he spoke differently when he spoke to you to how he normally does. He elevated language. And I wondered, like, oh, I wonder if these guys, who I see you guys as like very high up, you know, successful, intelligent, also have that kind of, I don't know, did you sense that at all?
Oh, say that again. I'm not sure I got that. You said he spoke differently.
He used, often he's doing sort of his YouTube and stuff, and he's speaking to, I suppose, people like me, lay people, and he uses shorter words. And when he was speaking to you, some of the sentences I found a little bit word salad-y. I find it very interesting, but it was like, I don't quite know what he's... And I noticed the same when he spoke to Stephen Fry. And I thought, when he speaks to you and Stephen Fry, is he elevating his language? And maybe there's this sort of competitiveness.
I wouldn't want to comment on that individual. I notice that I myself change my language when I'm speaking to... when I'm writing for children. I've written a couple of books for young people. And then when I'm writing for adults, let's say, I, without really thinking about it, if I read those books, I notice that my vocabulary does change. You have in your mind, I think, an audience, a sort of hypothetical audience, and it does change the way you speak, the way you write. It does for me.
With regards to, we were talking about, you know, the binary women and men, and the idea that you can think that you're a man and be a man, or think you're a woman. Did you see that coming at all, like 10, 20 years ago?
Not at all, no.
It is odd.
I think it's lunatic, actually. I mean, it's verging on insanity. I did not see that coming. I mean, I could have imagined writing a satirical novel about it, but that's about it.
Yeah. I remember Ricky Gervais makes a joke about that when he says, I think it was just that. It was like the one thing nobody said 10 years ago, that would be the worst thing you can say on Twitter, is women don't have penises. Now that would get you.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can think to top that is identify as a dog. I mean,
I can imagine now there'll be so many angry comments even now just from this. And I don't know. It's a weird thing. I want to respect everybody and understand everybody, but it just really is something that... Okay, so if you have to really stretch your mind, is there any scientific backing for the concept of somebody's, like, there's a woman brain and a man brain, and so
there might be that. There might be that, but to go from that to saying because you have a female outlook on life or something, therefore you are a woman. I mean, that is just debauching language. It's one thing, and it's perfectly legitimate to say, I'm a man, but I feel a certain feminine attitude to things. I think like a woman. That's fine. I mean, that doesn't worry me at all. But to then say, therefore, I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language, of truth and the virtues of honest communication.
I find the ideology very conservative, because it tells me that if my son wants to play with things that are typically feminine or stereotypically feminine, then they have to change to fit in. They have to become a woman to fit in with that.
Yes, I quite agree.
It's a crazy thing, really. So, okay, so if we are just to go out there a bit, I mean, are there aspects of brains that are male and typically female?
Probably. I don't know much about it. I wouldn't wish to deny that. But it's not a very profound observation. I think that you can find aspects of feminine sympathy in some male people and vice versa, and it would be surprising if that were not so. But as I said, but to go from that to the positive statement, "I am a woman," is verging on insanity.
Hmm. Is it dangerous?
Well, I think that certain people like Kathleen Stock and J.K. Rowling have suffered in their lives and their careers as a consequence of speaking out on behalf of women, and they so far haven't, I think, actually suffered physical danger, but some of them have come close to it.
The saddest part about J.K. Rowling is that she was abused by her first husband and left in the street in a pool of her own blood in Portugal.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, before she wrote Harry Potter. And she had a very difficult time during that time. So for her, it's a really personal thing, about women's spaces and changing rooms and things like that.
I did not know that.
It's so sad. It's so sad to think that. And then she, the Harry Potter stuff, I mean, it's an analogy for the Nazis. I don't know. Have you read Harry Potter?
I have, yes.
Did you enjoy it?
I didn't. Well, yes, I enjoyed it. I held out against it for a while, but then I discovered that Stephen Fry was reading it, and I can't resist Stephen Fry, and so I listened to him, and I liked it. I mean, quite a lot of what I like is that she's actually sending up the magical stuff. I mean, it's kind of satirical. I didn't know it had anything to do with the Nazis. That's
the whole. Well, as it goes further into the whole mythology, I think there's like the good and the bad and the pure bloods.
I've only read the first 2 or 3 books, I think.
It's funny because it's so brilliant. I'm going to show off now, right? So I can speak 5 languages, and each time I learned a new one, I did it through Harry Potter in Spanish or French. So there's the 7 books, I'm not sure. And what's brilliant about it as a language tool is they start very much for children. They're like for a reading age of 11 or 12, and the writing becomes a little bit more complex.
Yes.
It's not Dostoevsky at any point, but it starts to get there by the final book. You're really in this big epic about the bad people who want everyone to have the pure blood, you know, like the Nazis.
Okay, yes, that sounds very interesting. I shall resume my Stephen Fry listening.
He's great, Stephen Fry. Yes. I heard him talk a little bit about doing those audiobooks, and there were certain words he was tripping over. And
I heard that. Yeah.
He asked J.K. Rowling, can I do different words? And she said no.
Yes.
Which, fair enough, if you're the writer, you know. Gosh. Stephen Fry, have you done debates with him? I'm just remembering now, because I know he did Intelligence Squared. Was that with you or was Christopher Hitchens?
Yes, it was Christopher Hitchens. I've encountered him from time to time. I like him enormously. He's a wonderful man.
We should get him in. I'd love to meet Stephen Fry as well. Mm. Fantastic person. So the J.K. Rowling thing, I think, is really sad. Do you notice, I don't know, there sometimes seems to be different decades where we're a bit more is the word censorious?
Yes.
Yeah, we're a bit more censorious for sort of a decade, and then we sort of relax a little bit. Children rebel against their parents. Yes. Do you think that might be what's really going on?
Possibly. Yes, could be.
What does the poetry of reality mean? That's your Substack at the moment and podcast coming out?
Yes. Well, I think reality, as understood by science, is amazing and wonderful, and the fact that we can apprehend it, the fact that we can understand it, the fact that we, unlike any of our ancestors up to a century or so ago, 2 centuries maybe, really hadn't a clue why we existed and where we come from. And we now have a very good understanding of that. And it's beautiful. I mean, the beauty of understanding, the poetry of understanding is what I mean by science as the poetry of reality.
I suppose some people could argue, because they used to think stars were, I think, what, holes in the heavens or something.
Yes.
That, in some senses, that's more beautiful than bubbles of gas.
It's not.
No.
No.
And why is it? Because it's truth that it's more beautiful?
Well, partly that, but also, apart from being true, the alternative, the idea of it being holes in the sky, is just so petty. It's so small. It's so unromantic. It's just parochial.
I sort of wish it were true sometimes.
Oh, come on.
Because I want to go, I want to continue living.
Well, that's okay. You go on. But I mean, believing that the stars are holes poked in the sky is not going to help you continue living.
Well, the suggestion would then be, like, if the heavens were beyond it and it's heavenly light pouring through, the suggestion would be that I then get to ascend to that plane.
If you want to go on living, I wouldn't go and live in the the heaven of any religion.
I would.
Incredibly boring.
Yeah, better, well, less boring than the alternative.
I doubt it.
Really?
I doubt it.
I always think of, like, okay, how, because I, my religion would be, because I'm an atheist as well, and I, again, all my viewers start messaging, no, you're not, you're an agnostic because you don't know, or something like that. But, you know, I think, I mean, I would say I'm probably an atheist. I definitely am. But my religion is sort of a thing probably at the back of my head that's going, but you're never going to really die. So you're going to be, maybe there'll be virtual reality. I was thinking about this, some sort of virtual reality that makes you experience time when you're in the virtual reality. You know, you can spend years and years, but you're actually lying there in real life for just seconds.
Yes.
If they could slow down your mind or something like that. So I'm sort of holding out for that.
Wishful thinking.
Or that they'll discover something in quantum physics. Is there anything there?
No, I don't think so. No, I think you've got to face up to reality.
Never. Is there a time when that happens? Did you have angst younger about that reality?
Yes, I suppose so, yes.
Professor Paul Bloom said recently, he was saying that you spend your first half of your life sort of writing your CV and the second half is you're writing your eulogy. Does that resonate with you?
No. I think I don't make any distinction between first half and second half. I've been doing the same thing all the time.
Mm. He was trying to make me feel better, I think, about getting older. And he was like, yours get used, you'll accept more and you'll look at your sort of...
I see, yes. Mm. I just carry on thinking I'm about 18 and getting on with what I do.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to do it. The poetry of reality, tell me a little bit about what that's... I mean, it's a Substack now, right? And then it's going to be a podcast?
Yes, it is. And I shall be... I'm doing much the same as what you're doing, I think. I mean, I shall be interviewing people and probably doing some contributions of my own, maybe writing stuff directly and putting up things that I've done before, putting up on the YouTube channel, putting up broadcasts and things that I've done before.
Yeah. Have you got interviewees in mind yet? Because I haven't received my invite yet.
I haven't given it very much thought, but yes, that sounds a good possibility.
Yeah. Would you get me on?
You'd love it, would you?
Yeah, of course I would.
Yeah, okay.
I'm up for that. I think I can offer a layperson perspective to things. Maybe that's what you want.
I mean, I think we could talk about your Argentinian
exorcist.
Yes, that would be very good.
I would be up for that. You've had to say yes because I've cornered you now.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't get an email back later. I was looking at some of the discussions that are on your Substack because I think these are really interesting and maybe we can go
into... It's only been open for about a day, hasn't it? I think so.
Yes. Yeah. I'm on these, you know, I'm checking out all the stuff. What is this? Scientists in the US and Canada banned the words women, mother, and father. That's not one of yours, actually. That's just me saying it, isn't it? There are some words.
I never said that. Yes.
Yeah, that was just me. my notes were mixed up.
Yes.
There are some words that I suppose they go into the other side of your brain, I'm told. Again, you'll know more about this than I will. But I remember, again, Stephen Fry put his hand in some cold water. And if he swore a lot, it enabled him to do it for longer. And I think the reasoning was that these words were in a sort of, they weren't in the language, they were sort of on the other.
I see.
Does that make sense?
I don't know.
Yeah. So I just assume you'll know all the sciencey things, but they're all different, it's different domains, isn't it? And those words apparently go into the other side, swear words, sacred words. You might not say Well, I know I'm not allowed to say the N-word, for example. Is that reasonable?
I know nothing about what is what reasonable?
That we shouldn't say the N-word.
Well, I think you have to... Yes, I mean, I think it's reasonable, yes.
Yeah, or there's an F-word for gay people.
Okay,
a bundle of sticks.
Yes, I had to think about that. Yes, okay.
Those are like... Well, that's the interesting... This was also John McWhorter, actually.
Yes.
He was saying that these sacred words... I love the linguistic stuff. And he was saying that sacred words change over time.
Yes.
So it was bodily functions... Fuck, shit, hell. I don't mind saying these. It's not going to get my YouTube taken down. First was the religious ones. Hell, damn, those kinds of things.
Yes.
Then it was shit and fuck. They became the...
Yes.
They were, as we moved on as a society. And then it became identity. That's been the last 30, 40 years.
As long as that, is it? Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, that's we've moved into that. And it's... I guess some of us, we're trying to come to terms with it. But they've become sacred like any other religion.
Yes, that's interesting. Yeah,
I said, like, well, what will be next? And he said, you never know, but it could be something like related to climate change, as that's going to become incredible. He said, imagine calling somebody a windmill.
Yes, that's interesting.
I like that. Mm. Yeah, I love thinking about those kinds of things, but with the linguistics.
I do too,
It might just be a temporary phase with this identity thing.
Yes, it might.
And there are good reasons as well, I suppose. Mm. It often comes from a good place, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it does.
There once existed a single individual female who was the most recent ancestor shared by you and a baboon. That one individual female had two individual children, one of whom is your ancestor, the other is the baboon's ancestor. Discuss.
Yes, I'm interested in that. It's another of these things that's got to be true, but you can't. It's difficult to see why it's true. Since we do have a common ancestor with baboons, you have to go back and back and back and back. And sooner or later, you're going to hit one individual mother who had these two children. Then we're both descended from her mother and her mother and her mother. But there has to have been one point, which was the branch point. And it was a single individual. And not just baboon, but snail. Our common ancestor with a snail, which was way, way back in the Precambrian. And there has to have been an individual, which would have been, goodness knows, some kind of worm, I suppose. And we're descended from one child of that individual, and snails are descended from the other one.
Wow. Yeah.
Not just snails, but insects and crustaceans and spiders and on the other side, on our side, would be starfish and sea urchins and tunicates and things.
The way my childish mind works is I'm seeing like a snail having sex with a starfish.
Well, you're wrong.
I know.
Yes.
I know. My mind creates a cartoon of everything.
Yes.
So, but I guess it was just all, so there's, I guess, there's, does that mean there's one baboon that all of us have come from?
No, one individual that all of us came from and baboons came from. I mean, they're modern animals just as much as we are. We didn't come from them.
Oh.
Well, you know that.
Yes, I know that.
Yeah.
I don't give it much thought. There's things I know, and then many years later, I don't know them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be reminded of them. This is you as well. If there is extraterrestrial life, it's nice getting your questions. I don't have to come up with questions. If there is extraterrestrial life, no matter how strange and alien it may be, there is one thing it will have in common with Earth life. It will be Darwinian.
Yes, what you're doing is you're quoting... I, on my Substack, I put up a sort of manifesto, and I thought of the way to do it was to put up a series of statements like that, just one after another. I think about 20 of them, probably.
Yeah, every one blew my mind.
And so that's and you've been reading out a couple of them, and very nice too. Thank you. and that one was, yes, if there is life elsewhere, and there almost certainly is, then it will be Darwinian. However strange it is, however alien it is, however hard it is for us to imagine the details of what it's like, I stick my neck out and say that one thing we can say about it will be Darwinian. It will have evolved by a version of Darwinian natural selection. I think that's the only possible way in which complexity, the sort of complexity we associate with life, could come into being.
It's such a fascinating
thing. That's open to refutation by somebody who can think of a better way.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, we only know that one way.
Yes.
So we have a confirmation bias.
Yes, exactly.
It's difficult to imagine. I suppose one other possibility, although it has, this is a cheat, I suppose, would be artificial life that was created by...
Yes, definitely. But that ultimately comes from a Darwinian source. So, yes, not just artificial life, but the technology generally, which has many of the attributes of life, the complexity of life, does not evolve itself necessarily. You could make a case that it does, but I wouldn't want to make a strong case for it. But if there is advanced technology on a planet, then ultimately that will have to have come from a Darwinian life form that designed it.
That's a really interesting thought. Mm-hmm. Do you give much thought to the... is it the Fermi paradox?
Where are they?
Yes.
Where is everybody? Yes. Fermi, the physicist who said, where is everybody? he was wondering why they haven't made contact with us, why we haven't picked them up. You shouldn't wonder why they haven't arrived. We're never going to meet them in person. I think the distances are too great, but, it's a worthwhile enterprise to scan the heavens for messages, and it's an active SETI. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Mm. SETI is an active project, which is, I think, well worth financing.
Do you think then that when the Navy, I know the last couple of years there's been some news about they've spotted UFOs and things like that. Do you think that might be just wishful thinking?
Yes, I don't believe that. I think that if there is ever a first contact, it will come by radio or by electromagnetic radiation of some sort.
Hmm. Is that because, again, I don't know much about radio and electromagnetic. Is that just the standard that they would use as well?
Well, no, it's that it travels at the speed of light and it broadcasts in all directions at the speed of light, and therefore, since such huge distances that are involved, you would not expect that an actual physical spacecraft would happen to come here. There are just too many other places for it to come to, and the probability of this one place in the universe, Earth, being the target of an actual mission is too low. But if it's being broadcast outwards from some point source, then yes, it's not unlikely that we would be, along with everybody else, every other part of the universe, bathed in this message, and so we would pick it up.
And yet, silence.
So far, but then we haven't had the technology to listen to it for very long, and I think there's quite a lot of hope that we will pick up something.
Do you think that would be the greatest discovery of all time?
Probably, yes. Certainly you could make a good case for that.
Would you accept then if they came down and if they actually came here but killed us all quite quickly and painlessly, that it might be worth it just for the moment of awe?
Well, I don't think that. But I don't think it would happen either, because I don't think that they would be able to get here. Yeah. I mean, if they picked up a return message from us, it would probably take 1,000 years to get to them. And so it's not a thing you can worry about actually physically coming here.
Unless they've been planning it for so long in secret and they use like wormholes or something.
I don't know enough physics to talk about that.
I suppose something that's more imminent and likely is maybe AI. People worry about AI, artificial intelligence.
Yes.
One thing I don't get, everyone's talking about, okay, we need the problem of alignment. We have to align our concerns with theirs, or, you know, so that they want to do good for humanity, which in itself is impossibly difficult because every human wants something slightly different. And that if we get it wrong once and they're able to self-duplicate or whatever it might be, self-improve, that we're done. That's it.
Yes.
But I don't understand why AI would want to get rid of us or kill us.
Well, it would depend upon what sort of aims were built into them, I suppose. You could say if you build into them, maximize the total happiness and minimize the total suffering in the world.
Well, that would kill us.
It might. you could make a case for it, I think.
Oh, my. Is that what you were going to say when I interrupted you? Sorry.
Yes. Well, just a point that depending upon what the utility function you build in is, you could. This is very speculative.
It makes for a really sort of creepy dystopian novel, that this idea that we're doing you good. Like, oh, I suppose that's Hal. Is it Hal 3000 in the
two? Hal. Yes. Do you know how Hal got his name, by the way?
No.
It's IBM one letter back in the.
Oh, no way.
Yes.
HI. I believe you.
Yes, IBM. You go back one to H and then
Wow. Did that reflect concerns that IBM building all this computer stuff would be the end of us?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just a little joke that Arthur C. Clarke thought of at the time.
It's creepy, though, isn't it? Mm. I'm afraid I can't let you do that.
Yes.
Are you good at accents?
No, I don't think so.
Do you think an AI can be sentient?
I think I've got to say yes, but because we are, and we are built of physical stuff, and so there has to be some way in which whatever it is that our brain has that makes us sentient must be simulatable in a computer medium.
So if we built another Richard Dawkins just right here with all exactly the same stuff, he could even have your memories.
That is a fascinating thought. I think that's got to be true. And then the question, philosophers like that kind of thought experiment, and you start to wonder about things like, would we be exactly the same? Would we diverge from that point? I suppose we would initially have exactly the same experiences and feelings. Would one of us feel the pain of, if you stuck a pin in one, would the other one feel the pain? I think the answer to that is probably no. And as time goes on, our experiences would drift apart and we would no longer be the same person. I think it's quite a good thing that philosophers do this kind of thing. It's one of the things they do that I think is quite worthwhile, these sorts of thought experiments like that.
Well, one of the first things about philosophy I read, I must have been about 7 years old, and I read this book, and I don't remember what it was. Maybe someone will write in and tell me, but it was pink. And I seem to remember there was like an elephant on it, but it was for teenagers to read, I think, or children. And it had this thing where, this story where people go to Mars to sort of mine for whatever they're mining in Mars every day for work. They're commuting. So they were getting into a machine and it transports them there right away, like in Star Trek or whatever it is. And then you're on Mars and you come to realize what it's actually doing is destroying you and rebuilding you as a clone, I suppose, on the other planet. And now you can't get home. You know, and the question is, would you then walk into it and go back home?
Yes, it's one of a family of thought experiments which I find interesting.
Would you?
I need notice of that question.
Yeah, I think I would just have to stay on Mars, because I don't think the one of me that's created on Earth, I don't think I'd be aware of that existing.
Yes, no, you wouldn't be aware of it, no.
Thank you, Richard Dawkins. I would also like to give a big shout out to my lovely fiance, Julieta, who we just spent the day getting towed by a tow truck or lorry or whatever because our car broke down. What a palaver that all was. And we've just gotten back. As I record this, it's 10 past 10 at night and we get this up by midnight, I was going to say Wednesday night, but I suppose it's Thursday morning. Midnight, I guess you say midnight Wednesday when you're talking about for Thursday. I don't know. Between Wednesday and Thursday, betwixt the two, we get this episode up and running. So she's just editing the whole episode right now, and she's got an hour and 50 minutes to finish it. If you're listening to it right now, it means that she achieved it. But I'm throwing some love her way, as well as Richard Dawkins's way. So go to the Poetry of Reality Substack, sign up, and you will know all about his podcast coming out soon. I might go on it now, which is pretty cool. I'd love that. Keep watching. Big, fun, exciting, on the edge episodes are coming up.